Welcome, welcome, welcome. You're listening to another exciting sit down of the Mind Frame podcast, where we sit down and talk about the events of the current chapter. So this time we are talking about chapter 3. As always, it's up to you whether you want to listen to this before the chapter or the chapter before this, but we will be spoiling things, and a lot of stuff won't have a lot of context if you listen to this one before the chapter. And as always, we'll be talking about what's in the chapter and answering questions. And some of them I can't answer, so the questions can't reveal too much because I don't want any spoilers, but we do our best to walk that fine line. We appreciate all of you who are listening, because that means that you're all patrons and you're awesome from whatever tier of patronage you decided upon. But we do thank you, and we want to always give you some good content in addition to the regular episodes, and that's what our sit downs are all about. So with me as normal is Zach Smith.
Hello.
And Brent Van Tassel.
Yo.
And we are a member of the Podbelly Network. So if you need some information on podcasting, or if you want to find a really great network of other podcasts, you can go there and find our cousins in podcasting, find some new shows that might be interesting to you. We plug them on the regular episodes, so I know you hear a lot about them in that respect. So without further ado, let us get to some questions and see where our sit down takes us. And we are officially sitting down. I don't think we're drinking whiskey at this point, because I think we are already had some.
I had a little bit.
I had a little bit already. A little bit. You still drinking some a little bit?
Yeah, a little bit more.
A little bit. Okay. That's all right.
So this chapter is seemingly taking place the furthest we have in our timeline, 2142. So just kind of want to throw that one out there. Mm-hmm. I noticed I hadn't mentioned it in my questions yet. So with this chapter, we have some locales come up that would be very familiar to people from Bakersfield, Mojave, and Tehachapi.
Yes.
Were they selected because it seemed natural to incorporate Edwards Air Force Base, and or because of familiarity? Familiarity? There we go.
I think it's really because of Mojave. Like, when I started researching and writing this, and it still is, there's a Mojave spaceport, and a lot of smaller space startups are around there. That's where they're trying to do a big push to get privatized. You know, that's where Virgin Mobile did its big launches, all that stuff. I think Elon Musk has thoroughly kicked all their asses. And doesn't use Mojave, I don't believe. Or he does, though. Does he use Mojave?
I think SpaceX took off.
Did they do that? I know that they've done. I know that we've seen, because
I've seen some rockets.
Yeah, exactly.
Stuff,
living in Bakersfield, every so often you'll see a what in the hell is that in the sky that looks like nothing you've ever seen before.
Even after hearing what it was, I was like, really, though?
That
looks
that
crazy.
Was.
Like blue-green spiraling. I was like, that couldn't have gone well, whatever it was, because it sure didn't look like a straight trajectory. So if that's your explanation, it didn't work.
Right. So, I mean, but just that, you know, the Mojave Desert is sort of the gateway to Area 51 and Edwards Air Force Base and all these great expanses of secret Air Force, U.S. military test ranges. And it's that way for a reason. A, it's far away from civilian population.
Right.
So if you're doing top secret stuff, that makes sense. But B, it's away from civilian populations. So when you're testing some ridiculous piece of, airplane that's never flown before, if the whole thing blows up, it's not going to kill anybody but the pilot.
Right,
like, there's
right.
no civilian population to be at risk. So when we've got this future of 2142 and we're building all this crazy cutting edge technology, it's got to be test flown somewhere, and that's a great place to test fly it. That's also, you know, ideally you would think there was, by 2142, there would have already been an infrastructure there. And even thinking about the fact that you would need a certain scope for a space ramp that you would like launch trajectories from, you would need a big blank, you
large
know, tablet
area.
Of Earth for that. So just multiple reasons for Mojave. I mean, it helped. I mean, I'm sure I could have found, like, you know, the Changwon Peninsula in China,
right.
which I've never been to and never will. So I'm not even going to, I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of other test beds for places or launch areas, but this is one that I think is a logical place, and it doesn't hurt that it's one I can easily get to and have been to enough that I can kind of write about. So.
Yeah, I think I loved it partly because you know, they always talk about authors writing about where they come from, and I feel like Bakersfield is definitely in this area of California is underrepresented. We have tons of LA fiction, San Francisco fiction, but I don't feel like our area has got much. So I thought it was really cool to see.
I also think it's funny because I know a lot of people who have come from Bakersfield to write for a living. A lot of people, you know, come through school in Bakersfield and then transfer from Bakersfield College to go to UCLA or USC where they write screenplays or they become staff writers on a TV show or whatever. And the only thing that you know about the fact that they were there is there's a really awful Bakersfield joke somewhere in this sitcom. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, they never show up and represent the area.
Like Castaway, like it's the outhouse, you know, the shit house floating in the ocean in Bakersfield.
Yeah. The Cell.
The same thing.
I always wonder things like that. Like, why did they pick the reference to Bakersfield? It is some little sneaky Easter egg joke.
I was watching some horror film that was like, they're driving from, I think, like Portland down to LA, and they took like a specific like 15 seconds out of the film to be like, I'm driving through some pencil dick town named Bakersfield.
Yeah. It's usually derogatory.
I usually assume that the writer is from Bakersfield.
Yeah, it could
be.
That's
my assumption.
Yeah. You know, I'm just like, though, you drove through Stockton, you drove through Tracy, there's plenty of piece of crap town.
You drove through
California.
Delano.
Like, perfect.
It's funny, too, like the reaction that it causes, though. Like, you can't help but be almost excited like a little kid.
Oh,
like, did they just say Bakersfield?
You do
a somersault to grab the remote and try to rewind it.
Right.
I know Big Bang Theory, which I love that show. Like, at one point, they went through Bakersfield
did,
on
yeah.
their way to, like, Comic-Con or something. I was like, holy crap, they said Bakersfield.
You know, it's the one that's funny that no one ever brings up. I don't know if you guys have watched the Zach Galifianakis show, the Baskins or whatever.
Yeah.
It takes
I haven't
place
watched
here.
It yet, but
and I haven't either. And
not
just
actually
like,
filmed here, though. It's like
no, it doesn't. Yeah, not filmed here. I just always think it's funny that no one ever talks about it in Bakersfield.
Right. Misery, Misery is she's from Bakersfield.
Oh, is she?
Yeah,
I didn't know
she's
that.
Supposed to be from
there's a Tom Waits song at the very end. He says, "Let's take her to Bakersfield."
Oh, okay,
Short Circuit, obviously.
Oh yeah, Short
Bakersfield
Circuit
originally. Yeah,
yeah.
There's a ton of them.
So there, but yeah, I think a lot of them are. I'm not saying that they all are, but I know a lot of people, not that I knew even personally, but when my sister wrote in Hollywood, she met this little cabal of ex-Bakersfield expats who moved to LA and were in the writing industry and would talk shit about Bakersfield in their scripts every so often. So
Arnold Schwarzenegger, the butcher of Bakersfield.
Yeah,
that's true.
Man.
Yes,
who's Robin Williams, that Bakersfield versus Taft, like a football movie back in the day.
But that was real. No, that was real. That was a true story.
Yeah, because that's, was it Kathy Lee Gifford? Frank Gifford, I think, was like on that team.
All
like
I hear is South
that
Park when you
something.
Say Kathy Lee Gifford. Yeah. I hear, was it Kathy Lee Gifford?
But it is. I mean, it's obviously going to be a million times easier to write about a place that you're familiar with. Right. I mean, in 181 Pine, there's a whole chapter that takes place in Bakersfield,
right.
You know, and most of the book does not, but I was just like, and it was actually an idea from a friend of mine, and I was like, oh, that's perfect. That's
if I could plug that book real quick, guys, read that section just to see the image of people coming down the grapevine, trying to like come into Bakersfield after shitting on us for years. And then it's like, nah, buddy, go back to LA. Yeah. Fuck off.
Yep. Yep.
So
I got to steal it back from my mom. I saw it from afar. My mom has like a whole wall that's just like bookshelves.
Right. Right.
And we were talking about Chama was Chama. And so I saw it from afar and told her I was going to steal it back, but maybe I need to read the new version.
No, don't steal it back. We'll get you a new version.
All right.
Yeah.
A lot of people, people are listening, may have this question too. Want your new book autographed, but they've already bought it, so like now they're going to ship it. Like, I don't know what the best way to facilitate that is. I guess contact us, and maybe they could order it and ship it to us.
If you already have one, contact us, and we can order it and ship it to you. And if not, if you haven't even bought it yet, maybe that's a better way.
I don't know.
Sell your current one to a friend.
Yeah, there you
and
go.
Then use that money to buy a new one.
Leave it on the table
in
the coffee shop and go buy another one.
And I know we're going to do some giveaways of the book that are autographed, and we're going to do giveaways of a really awesome t-shirt. Mine just got shipped yesterday, so I should be getting a batch. The publisher already has their batch of the t-shirts, but we will be doing some giveaways and stuff like that, and I'm sure we'll be announcing them on Mindframe as they occur. So,
okay. So, my next question, just real quick, was what was the research process like for that? As far as was it just simply like driving the numerous times driving through Mojave and Tehachapi and seeing those like windmills, because that plays like a imagery throughout the chapter.
Yeah, for Mojave, I didn't really go there or anything, but Tehachapi, it was actually, I made my nephew sit through it because at one point a relative of mine lived there for a couple of months and then moved back to Bakersfield, but she needed help moving back. And I had a truck at the time, so I got my nephew, who's a strapping young lad, and we drove up there just to move her back down. And while we were up there, I was like, you know, I'm gonna buy you breakfast and lunch, and you're gonna move all this stuff and you'll get money because you're helping move, but when I'm up there, you're just going to have to kind of sit in the car for a while because I'm going to be taking some pictures and some notes. And while I was up there, I did take some pictures and drive around and kind of get a, you know, picture of Main Street and take some notes of the weather and what the hills were like. And, you know, so I did kind of capture some stuff that I could take back with me. But even if I wasn't going there for that, I would have still driven up there. Ultimately, when I write in more depth about the details of that battle, I will make a day trip, you know, up there to like really spend some time. And
I was going
to
say, is it inconsequential because it's raised to the ground? Like windmills came out of that, but
right.
Later it will matter, I guess. Or there's a jump back to talking about why and how.
Well, at some point the battle itself will be covered.
Okay. So, answer a question I had later. So we will get to see the battle, which I'm very excited for.
Not for a while. Not for a while.
You know, it's like one of those things where it's like Obi-Wan mentioning the Clone Wars in the very first Star Wars.
And you're like, oh, builds up the Clone mythology. Wars?
And then, of course, we get the Clone Wars. I'm not saying yours is going to be like that. Right, I'm just excited for it.
Yeah.
But Yoda's battle scene was pretty badass.
That was pretty badass.
He's like a pinball machine.
And actually, I'll throw out that the prequels I enjoyed more than 7, 8, and 9, but that's me.
Yeah.
As far as process, has anything changed in your writing knowing it would become a podcast/audiobook?
It does change things. Before every chapter, I mean, I've read these chapters 100 times, editing them and polishing them and adding detail. But every session when I sit down to read a chapter, I print it out and I go back through and look at it. And it's something that came from way back when I had a radio show. And even like the very, very early days of Sofa King podcast, I would write out a copy of like an introduction and be like, on this episode, we blah, 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 blah. And when you're writing copy that has to be spoken out loud, you'll just hit a sentence and it's like, you'll see someone read it 5 times in a row and screw up 5 times in a row. And it's like, it's not because there's something wrong with that person. It's the sentence. Like there's too many puh sounds in a row and it throws your brains off, or it's like some. So when I'm rereading it, I do every so often look at, like, before I read it out loud, I go back over it, and every probably 2 or 3 times per chapter, I'm like, that's not going to fly.
Yeah, you don't always speak like you write or write like you speak.
Right.
And probably as English professors, I imagine, like, you know, like I had a family member I was helping struggle through English a little bit, and it was like, you don't write like you talk,
right?
Like it's much more eloquent, and it's just a different thing. And I think people sometimes probably don't make the connection. Obviously you would think you would anticipate that, but until you try to say something, and you write some real tongue twisters,
sure,
like there's some notable stuff where I'm like, wow, like you've done that to yourself, sir.
Well, it's a certain trick of the language when your eyes are on the page, and it's a different trick of the language when you're the bastard who has to read it out loud.
But impressively, being the man that hits stop and re-record, like you roll through some of that stuff where I'm almost like, okay, don't even say anything. Like I'm going to be the one that messes up because I'm so impressed that you made it through that.
But some of them I will, you know, a couple times per chapter when we're reading it out loud, I'll mess up on a sentence and then I'll say, okay, hold on a second. And then I just retweak the sentence to flip the order or change it or cut apart or because it's not.
And those changes will only be reflected in the podcast. Like that's not an edit to the book. So the book will be untouched.
Yeah, the book will still be. Yeah. So, and they're super minor changes. It's just so I don't trip on a sentence or, you know, and every so often I do. I do find mistakes when I'm reading and I circle them, and I do find that sentence just doesn't make sense now that I'm really looking at it, and I switch it and then I make a note, switch this in the book as well. But, and you know, I've still got a chunk of chapters to write. And when I write those chapters, I will be more aware of I'm reading this out loud, but that won't be my primary. Like I take that back. I think I'm just going to write the way I always
write. You should ignore
that
because I think that might have to do with the age old quote, the book is always better than the film thing. Because you can describe things in such detail that you can't translate to video or audio possibly. You know what I mean?
No, I'll still stick with it. Like we said on the last sit down, like even like the the Filipino.
That's what I was going to bring up.
Terms.
Filipino
it's
and
like
the Russian.
I just got rid of them, yeah. You know. And when I have to speak Russian, I might just, you know, tweak that part of the podcast. But when you get the book, you'll see the Russian term.
I remember,
you know, I don't know what's better, me butchering Russian or like tweaking it so the word
isn't
there. I think
in this day of technology, at least someone can Google the Russian word and probably hear the enunciation. Like when I read Lord of the Rings, like that wasn't a thing you couldn't.
Right.
And so I was on
like.
Well,
you still technically can't do because those aren't. Real you, words.
You could, right. Well, maybe at some point, at least in the film, it was expressed like
right,
Theoden
yeah.
or something. Theoden, I remember like
reading. I'm sure there's a wiki with a little pronounce
there,
this
that's
button.
True. Yeah.
So, but back when I was reading the book, I would just get to Theoden and be like,
Eden.
Theoden. Yeah, like that T guy or something would happen in my head. Some big, much, something much more time consuming and that took more energy to say. But I would just hit that, and it was a speed bump every time.
Right,
the one
it
was for me when I was a kid was adamantium.
Oh,
shit,
yeah.
I'm
oh, really?
Yeah, I never knew how to say it. So, like, it wasn't until the ninth, whenever the Fox
cartoon
came out.
Yeah,
and then I was like,
adamantium.
I can't even remember how I butchered
how you
it.
Said it.
Yeah, but it was like adamantium or something. I don't know. But it was just like, oh, okay, that's definitely not what I was saying in any way, shape, or form.
That's on Disney Plus now, by the way.
And I saw. Good thing they bought out Fox.
Yeah.
All right. So we kind of approached this question before and just kind of seeing what we can get now. Is there anything you can tell us about the framing position in the World Navy?
The framers, I'll only say, I don't want to say too much about the framing, but I want to hear what you guys have to say about the framing first. And there's one thing that I will say about it, but I don't want to say a whole lot because it'll give away some reveals. So I'm curious what you guys think about the framing, like what that is.
I remember your description of the framing chamber and like the smooth white, you know, like, I don't know, weird, a chamber. And I was like, it's a physical chamber. There's a framer. Is the framer go in the chamber? You know, I was trying to like figure out what's going on there. And between the shows, Zach and I discussed a little bit between recording that, like maybe I had a thought that it was something like a navigable calculation. Like if you're a framer, like I picture like the nautical guy with the map that has the protractor and the pin making measurement and calculations from some astral, you know, calculation to figure out where to go. And then maybe it's something that in time and space that there's a different three-dimensional, you know, you're not on the sea. You know what I mean? There's things to be done, and I think that maybe framing might have something to do with that. But at the same time, I was like, but this technology is like this unknown technology to them.
I think what I came up with kind of based on our discussion and thinking back to how the messengers in this chapter are mentioned, and they're telepaths. So in my head, a framer is also a telepath that does what you're talking about, which is they're framing the position in space that they're trying to get to within their head, and that's how they help navigate. Because it's that whole thing about like what Han Solo said when he didn't want to go to light speed in Empire. It's like, we can just run right into a comet and that would screw us. So maybe the framer is there to help prevent that. They're trying to, maybe they can see a little bit into the future where stuff's going to go. That's my guess right now.
So the only thing that I was going to say about the framers, you kind of touched on, which is when you look at the different branches of the government that exist, there is the branch that is capped by the messengers, and the framers are in that branch.
They're part of that pyramid government. Scheme.
That's part of that's their pyramid scheme. That's about all that I'm willing to say about the framers.
And there's a framing exam. So it's to me, I was like, it's something that can be learned.
Right. Or
studied
or
appointed.
Because like I think back to like Starship Troopers where Doogie Howser has to do the test to see like, oh, I can guess what that thing is. And then his friend can't do it. But he ends up with Denise Richards. So I think he kind of wins there too.
I will confirm that. The framing exam is testing your ability to be a framer.
Okay.
It's not a learned.
Okay.
It's not something you can learn.
Your proclivity, like your ability to be able to.
Like some people can innately do this thing, and the exam is to determine whether or not you're capable of doing whatever it is that they do.
Okay. My next question is: are names significant to you when choosing a name for a character? Does it need to have a deeper meaning / some form of foreshadowing, or is a name just a name, or both?
Both and neither. Names are important. Names of primary characters are things that I really spend a lot of time going over, and they're normally not symbolic of anything. Okay. It's just I finally have to settle on a name that's like, that's a great name. Like, I like that name. Or I know the character enough that when I finally think, there might be nothing surprisingly good about the name, but when I'm thinking about that character, I'm like, no, that's the perfect name for that character. Yeah. That is that character's name. Like, that's just the way it is. A lot of times for secondary characters, I do make an effort to find something that might have some symbolic meaning for foreign names, mm-hmm. you know, since most... you know, non-American names have meaning.
Yeah.
You know, I do try to find a name that has some sort of meaning that what ties into Butch a character. Mean? Yeah, exactly.
I'm almost nervous to hear like your influence from a name for something like Marcellus or something, because I don't want, and I won't even say it, because I don't want to make a connection to something else.
Right.
And immediately like a very unique name, like Marcellus, to associate a different character from a different type of thing.
Yeah.
Where I'm going to input that person every time. Right. I don't want to do that.
Well, I think the reason the question came to mind is something that kind of got pointed out in Pitch Perfect about Star Wars. It's like, it's supposed to be a big reveal that Vader was Luke's father. And then she points out Vader just means fucking father in German.
Right.
He's dark, like, father.
If you spoke German, this is no, it's right there in front of you.
Right.
So I always think about stuff like that.
Pitch Perfect reference over there. Look at this guy.
Nice.
I've seen both of them. If there's two, right, Ash, two?
I think there's three.
I think there might be three.
Okay, well, I've seen two.
Yeah. I saw two of them with my niece, yeah.
The other reason I thought of it too is because there's stuff that like Thomas Pynchon does where he like names a character Mike Fallopian, and it's funny
right
because it's like, well, who Fallopian, but it's also it's because he's delivering a message and I refer to Crying of Lot 49 because it's usually the one that has some of the funnier names, but like Oedipa Moss, like Oedipa referring to Oedipus, and you're just like, okay, well, what does this refer to? So just kind of that juggling act.
But a lot of and to be perfectly honest, a lot of times if it is a non-American name, once I do some research and, you know, I'll find a list of 1,000 name, you know, 1,000 Hindi names. Mm-hmm. And I look at look at name after name after name and finally find one that has the meaning that I want.
Yeah.
And once I settle on that name, I don't record that. I don't write it down. It's just, that's now that person's name.
Gotcha.
And it does have a meaning, but I don't even remember the language and I don't remember why I chose that name.
Gotcha.
But so
that's curious. Yeah. I wonder how that affects people that watch Star Wars when they, the whole time, it's just all they're hearing is, yes, father.
Like if you're in German, like in Germany, like watching this film, you're like, huh.
They're just saying father over and over.
Dark father.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's the dark father.
Yes, Lord father. Yes, Lord father. I'm like, is it religious? Like, is he a priest?
Kind of.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah. Well, kind of. Yeah.
He is, I mean, there's all kinds of crazy Nazi subtleties.
But I do wonder if a lot of Germans were like, it was like a religious, like if they thought it was a religious ranking.
Yeah.
Like if they thought Vader was the religious part, not Darth.
What's the what's the term for a religious government? Is it oligarchy?
No.
Theocracy?
Theocracy.
Okay, yeah. So I think it was like Dogma has this cutout scene where Matt Damon is just explaining that all of Star Wars is like the Empire is just a theocracy, which is why it's so like part of the reason why it's so thoroughly corrupt, like in addition to like many other reasons. So yeah, I agree with you. It could just be like, oh, he was a priest.
Right.
And
Very
intelligent Kevin Smith rant of breaking things down, like when he breaked down the game of pool and how racist it is, that whole scene in Chasing Amy, I think, or something. That guy goes off about that.
Yeah.
You're like, one of them,
yeah, you're like, wow, that does seem right.
My next question is just kind of about world building. Do you have fun coming up with the world? Do you consider it work, or is it a little bit of both?
Or is it the obvious outcome of what should just eventually
we need to build this,
the eventuality of like, this is what would happen probably.
It's just before I put a word on paper, like the world is already there. And everything that I'm writing is the characters just reacting to the world as it is.
So you're not evolving it. You're not like the next logical progression will be this from this.
This is the world already, like the world is fully formed in my head before I start writing about any of it. Before I even start thinking about the characters, like it's already there.
So we have to remember that Dave dreams like entire universes.
Right, right.
We just can't punch
hard. Part of me deeply hates him for this because like I have to sit there and be like, all right, I'm going to go do some research to help build this.
I just went to school and couldn't find my classes and he's creating entire like, you know.
But it's also easier, I would say, when you write science fiction because you're pushing forward.
Right.
So it's, you know, I would never want to write an entire novel that takes place in, you know, 1810 because everything would take a shitload of research and I'm not interested in doing it.
True.
You know, if I can get a grasp on what futurists say is likely, you know, if I'm writing about the next 50 years, I need a grasp on what people think is going to be in existence in the next 50 years and then the world can build itself, you know, but no, the world is usually already there and then the characters are just reacting to that world. And then the narrative is just reacting to the characters who live in that world. So it's all, so it's like, even like the obscurity of what's happening between the different time frames and all of that stuff. Like it's all just a necessary part of the way the world is and who these characters are and what they do and where they are. Like it's
to build itself as those characters interact, as events and time progresses. Like, do you feel like some of it builds itself? Like things surprise you? Like,
no, some of the things the characters do surprise me. Like within the world, I'm like, didn't see that coming. Like I didn't, you know.
Like, this is a pretty good book.
I love that too.
like I didn't know those two hated each other. And I had no reason to believe they would, but they just got off on the wrong foot. And I don't even know why that happened. It's like as I'm writing their first experience, it's like it just keeps getting more and more aggressive. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what? That's weird. Like they really don't like each other.
I mean, it's a simulation of sorts. You know what I mean?
Kinda,
like
yeah.
In a narrative sense, like you have created characters, it's like The Sims or something, and then what will happen when they meet, like that that part's to be seen, and they have their own, you know, they have their own personalities, they have their own histories, they have, you know, whatever they've got going on, whatever character and characteristics, like they're going to react a certain way.
And even in a previous sit down you asked about like my being very inclusive about character types, and it's like, and I think I said this then, it's like I don't, it's like that's just who the character always was.
Are,
like he was gay. Yeah. Like he was gay before he showed up in the chapter. Like he was gay before I wrote the first word about him. That's just who this guy was, you know.
Right.
So it's a lot of those decisions seem like they're not even being made by me. They seem sort of pre-made.
So that's a perfect unintentional lead into, can we look at someone like Commander B. Gay as someone whose life bettered because of WorldGov?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he even tells the story of his grandfather and how horrible life was in India before the war and before WorldGov. And, you know, he talks about, you know, within one generation to go from a person who's, you know, willing to kill a dog and eat its meat because you're starving his family to death. You're starving his family to death. Your family is starving to death, to being on a spaceship in the farthest reaches of the solar system, seeing wonders that human, like, you know, for one person to experience that shows like the way WorldGov sort of leveled the playing field and uplifted most of humanity in what it did.
If it doesn't give too much story away, how much would you say Claire's desire to serve is her own and how much is family tradition / duty?
That is a very good question. I never thought about it. I think it's her own. I think it's her own desire to do what she's doing. I would think if there's anything that ties in with her family, it's probably a desire to outshine her father more than a desire to like live up to his you know, family legacy or what they did.
She's also along for the ride and kind of going with the flow of things too, because she's voted into that position, right?
Yes.
So,
yes.
And she even says that she doesn't feel like she's qualified for it. She's pretty young. I don't know how, I mean, if you think about something like that, because she's what, 36?
I believe
36. And I mean, I don't know how old a captain should be of a ship, but that does seem like a pretty young age. If you thought about being president or something at 36, like you're responsible for all the lives on that ship. And that's a huge responsibility. But she's kind of like, I got voted in and I got voted in by my peers, like that it was a recommendation from actual military.
Right.
And then there's a popular vote. So it must be the thing. So she's going about it and doing it, but she's stepping on the ship and like looking at the tech and in awe of the slingshot and all that stuff. I feel like she's like, well, this is what I'm supposed to do. My father before me did it. I've been voted in to do it. So here I go. Like, what else are you going to do?
And I think that was like my question in my head, where it was, it something where it's like, you know, here's kind of the
like, what's the alternative?
The way we make money in our family is now, rather than being butchers or farmers, it's we're space captains.
Right.
So you're going to step into those boots as well. Or was it like a little bit of both, where it's like that kid who looks at their dad or mom who's a firefighter and they're like, oh, and then they play with the fire engine truck. Like, when I grow up, I would also like to be a firefighter.
Right.
Like,
right.
Kind of felt like a little bit of both for me.
Well, I think she was always, she knew she was going to be in the World Navy. That was always a part of it. I don't know if this is ever expressed anywhere in the book, but in her heart of hearts, she was always going to be World Navy. But even when, her father died, she was like she worked for the admiral. Like she worked for the fleet. She was support in that role. And I think she has always pictured herself being not the captain of a ship, but being someone who oversees even more logistically, but not that like wheels on the ground. Like I think she, you know, fully expected one day I'm going to be an admiral, but it's not necessarily going to be the root of me piloting a ship. It's going to be the root of me controlling the Naval Academy and then moving on to this. So I think the idea that I'm now a captain is daunting. And I think even though we don't get a whole lot of reason why, the ship itself that she's becoming captain to is a really big deal. Like there's a lot of symbolic value in this ship, and it's like, it's a very important post symbolically for the entire planet, for a whole lot of reasons. And I think that more than anything is what's kind of freaking her out.
Yeah. And I think for me, it's the idea of it touches on something older. And I'm not belaboring or mad that people don't necessarily continue in the tradition of what their, you know, father did before them. But I thought it was interesting that that was the job she chose. And then kind of what you're saying, it's like we always want our children to do better than us. And I think he expresses a lot of that in the prologue narration. So I thought, you know, maybe it's a little bit of both. And today, like if you had a friend that became, you know, a teacher and their mom was a teacher, their dad was a teacher, I think in our head we always kind of guess like, oh, is it because...
Right.
You wanted to do it? Is it because it's the family expectation, or is it a little bit of both?
I mean, people live and die in their hometown.
Yeah, right? For sure.
It's the rarity that you branch out and take off on adventure.
Yeah.
The, you know, probably 90% of the reason anyone's religious, I bet you don't have a lot of Catholic kids grow up and be Buddhist.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I think Ricky Gervais talks about that a lot. It's like, you are the religion you are because of it. You believe the things you believe because of your parents. Mm-hmm, and I mean, it's hard. It's an environmental thing. Like, it's the nature versus nurture.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And a lot of times, the nurture is a big part of it. Mm-hmm. You're influenced by it. Like, my dad growing up was an electrician. You know what I mean? And I was into electronics and crazy stuff. I own a computer shop. I build robots and take stuff apart. And I've always been into that kind of thing. And it's what was there. It was exposed. My dad played guitar. I play guitar. Those things happen. You know what I mean? I was actually an electrician for a little while.
Right, right.
And then my mom has been an entrepreneur, you know, and I have kind of have both of those things. So, you know, I have a business.
I guess in my head, like, do you feel that was unintentional? Like it just kind of, you just kind of naturally followed that progression?
I mean, I was into electronics. It was interesting to me and it was available. So like when it was time for science fair, my dad did cool things. Like we built these things or did these things, or my dad was always working on those things. So I was around it. And so it's like there's G.I. Joes and then there's my dad with a bunch of wires and craziness going on. Like I'm inquisitive by nature.
Right.
Like I'm going to look at that.
Yeah.
And then like my mom had a business, and like, I think maybe for a lot of kids, if your parent didn't have their own business like that, like my mom did crazy things from catering to selling antiques, you know, to having like shops. And it wouldn't even be an option on the table. It's not even a consideration if your parent didn't already do it. You would just think, like, I'm going to be a fireman, like every other little kid. But it's like, oh, I could have a business. So when I was little, like, I went around with a wagon and, like, Bubblicious and lemonade pitchers and went to doors and knocked on doors and sold, like, bubblegum and lemonade to people. And, like, I staged a play that wasn't even planned out and sold tickets to a play. And, like, two people came to this play. And I jumped over, like, empty 5-gallon Arrowhead water bottles and, like, did somersaults and climbed trees and yelled and hooted and hollered while they watched and paid $5. I didn't mean for that to rhyme.
I think they got their money's worth.
Yeah, I think they got their money's worth.
Yeah, so, and my mom would always be like, why are you at my door? I was like, oh, well, there's supposed to be a play at 2 o'clock. There's supposed to be some kind of, your son sold me tickets. Yeah, I got in trouble in the 7th grade for selling candy. You know what I mean?
Like, right,
yeah.
Right.
So I think that you do follow in your parents' footsteps most of the time. That's probably the default.
No, and I think she definitely did. I mean, I think she always would have been in the Navy. But like I said, I think her expected path would have been one of logistics, not one of command. Mm. So I think she still wanted to outdo her father and outdo everyone's expectations of her. But I don't think she ever expected command. Which is with logistics or tactics, it's like people aren't people.
Yeah.
Like it's all just numbers. But when you're the captain of a ship, those are people that are under your command. And that's something that she's not quite comfortable
with. That makes me think too, and it's something that didn't occur to me till like right now. And maybe when I was reading earlier, I don't know. It feels like it truly feels like there's a closer equality within the sexes.
For sure. 100%. Okay. 100%. Okay. Yeah. And I tried to show how uncomfortable she is around other people by seeing how awkward her relationship with her mother is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like if she can't even have a conversation with her mother, then she definitely can't have a conversation with her head engineer.
Right.
You know, she just has a disconnect there.
Brent, were you going to?
I was just saying that I think with military too, like maybe she wanted to go into logistics and maybe she wants to outdo her father. But I think in career paths in military, you have some say, obviously. Mm-hmm. People direct themselves in a certain manner, but you also kind of do what you're told.
For sure.
So if they're like, you're going to be in Texas now or you're going to be in Vietnam, like you're going to those places almost certainly.
100%.
And see how she has an allegiance and a trust in the system. And so when they vote her in, she's like, this must be what's right. Regardless of what I want to do personally, the system has chose this for me. Right. The people have chose this for me.
The vote has spoken.
The vote has spoken. And if she's trusted in the system her whole life, she's in the military, like she will do what is asked of her.
For sure. 100%.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. So we learn a little bit more about hierarchy in the world, commodores, sheriffs, messengers, and the resistance. Is there any general stuff you can tell the listener about them right now?
I think the branches that they represent are probably the more important things. So the sheriffs are with there's four main groups that oversee humanity. And one is the global police force. And the global police force's job is everything that you would think a modern day army, Navy, Air Force, or police force does.
Okay.
So whether it's a cop giving speeding tickets, whether it's the captain of a naval vessel that's an ocean-going naval vessel or a submarine or a fighter pilot of a earth-based jet or a soldier in the army, like that's all global police force. Any type of military policing or security done on the planet Earth is done by the GPF. So that's one group.
I noticed there's a disconnect between space tech and earth tech though, like still gas engines and like wheels on the ground. Kind of
right.
Thing.
Yeah. Right.
Which like maybe that's because I would assume that it's the people dreaming of the messengers, like they're not getting instructions for cool ships on the ground. They're getting instructions for things that will assist the lariat.
Yes. That's the whole point.
They don't, whoever's sending this information does not give a fuck if you have a hovercraft or a DeLorean,
I mean, you know, you're going to look at a giant military vehicle and it's like, really part of it was most vehicles on Earth are no longer gasoline vehicles. But, you know, it's going to be a lot of electric vehicles and so forth. But at the end of the day, if you have some giant military vehicle, a big ass hog of a diesel engine, is still a good thing, you know? So it's like some of those vehicles are like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Like, that's a great engine for what this thing needs to do. So why would we change it? You know? So, or like you said, the messengers didn't give us new tech for an armored personnel carrier. We're doing the best we can.
Right.
You know, so
it's not related to their end goal, which right. I did have a question or a thought, which you may or may not be able to answer. And that's, whoever, you know, is providing these dreams or giving these messages, this information, like I think about like Jodie Foster Contact, like that type of thing. Mm-hmm. Why not just come here? Why not just open the gate from their side? Like, is that an ability that they can't? Or, it made me think about a quote actually that we had talked about earlier. And it's give nothing to anybody, see instead how they earn it. Mm-hmm. And that was related to an old phrase that they used with just the Navy.
Right.
That Campana says. But I thought it might be relatable actually to whatever society is providing this information, because maybe just coming here, it's that whole Star Trek thing where like the class of society doesn't have warp capability yet, so we can't talk to them kind of thing.
Sure.
So are they not just coming here because we have to earn it? Like that we need to prove that we're capable of going through the motions societally as one world order to get to this level of humanity to qualify for this information.
Well, for one thing, as much as WorldGov is a democracy, they do kind of keep a certain lid on communications that the messengers have with the other beings.
Not giving us all the information.
Right.
Right.
And humanity knows that. Like, they know that we're, you know, a lot of this isn't stuff that we all need to know, and we're fine with it. Like, that's fine. Like, we know what, I know what I need to know to do my part.
And Deviant hasn't come into the picture yet, huh?
Not for a couple chapters.
Okay, I'll be quiet.
They have. They've been mentioned, even in the, that's who attacked Bill Campano, Deviant Fleet.
And that would be their concern, is that we don't have all the information.
Right. So, but the whole point is to open the Lariat, which is a gate, and it has to be opened by a corresponding gate on both sides.
That's what I was thinking.
So until this gate is built, nothing can come through.
Okay. So they couldn't get to us if they wanted to, basically.
And the gate is of such a scope and of such advanced technology that it has literally been the driving motivation of the entire human race for about 120 years, and it still isn't complete yet.
Wow.
So it is a massive, an undertaking that would, you couldn't even calculate how many dollars it would have cost to build this thing. I mean, it's been generations of humanity just dedicating themselves to this.
Earth does not contain the resources to be able to construct this thing.
Right.
They're harvesting asteroids, and that's where the Razor Class stuff comes in.
Absolutely. So the World Navy helps with all that. It gets the resources there. It's overseeing the construction of the Lariat and security of the Lariat, so no deviants can try to attack it. Then you've got the WorldGov, which, even though WorldGov is kind of the term that's used for, WorldGov is the governing system for the entire, for all of humanity. So that's what they do. Any governance, and they base it on a world vote, which is a lifetime up. You know, people get upvoted and downvoted. So on a regular basis, if you're at your job, when it comes time for a review, everyone in your job gets to vote on, are you doing a good job? Are you doing a bad job? And if you get a bunch of upvotes, you might be up for a promotion. And if you get a bunch of downvotes, you're either going to stay the same or get demoted. So there's a whole system of that goes on.
I think in a society, like, does that create fear? Like, fake?
Isn't China doing that right now? They're doing, like, societal votes?
They're getting into it. It's not really a vote, though. It's just a societal watching.
Gotcha.
But more than the individuals, though, any major governing decision, you know, are made by a true, there's no electoral college. It's like, are we going to build a road here? Like, the city needs to vote on whether or not we want a new trash, you know, facility. The entire city votes.
Not talk about, I'm just wondering, like, would that not create like fakery? Would it not be like the ultimate permanent white lie where you're not ever really you, because the end goal is to make sure you get your vote? Like, are people different? Like, I feel like you would have a loss of humanity of sorts, because it's like, do I look fat in this dress? No, honey. You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing because she's got a vote. That person at work has a vote. Like, you don't like that guy, but you have to put up with him because, and that might be way more deep into like the societal structure of that voting system.
Those are all valid points to raise.
Because of Instagram, Facebook,
right?
Twitter,
exactly my thought.
Themselves,
you would begin to present your social media version of yourself almost like, oh, hey, I got a new car. These were all my happy moments. It was my birthday. I hang out with my friends. None of the sad stuff happens. Nothing would actually get out, and no one would have any real conversation unless it was extremely intimate or it was a close person, like a couple or a family member. But even in that, I'm sure there would be some equilibrium type situation where you would not even be outspoken in front of your children because they might vote you down or something.
But it would also, I mean, at this, if it was truly being done in a democratic sense, though, you would also be able to look at someone and be like, this motherfucker only upvotes everything. That guy is a liar and a phony.
True.
And his vote is going to suddenly have less clout.
Yeah.
Because he votes for, like,
he's a yes man.
You would also start to look, because some votes aren't for the entire world. Some votes are, you know, like if you're voting a person up in a ship, it's going to be a vote of a handful of captains and the members on that ship.
It would be the equivalent of checking someone's Yelp review and be like, man, this person hated this. And you click on their name and like, they fucking gave 27 bad reviews every restaurant ever. Yeah. Like, never mind. That doesn't count anymore.
So at some point, the world vote would be like, don't include him as much because he's a... So the world vote is looking for honesty in votes as well. Like, that's part of the system. And if you've got sophisticated enough computers, it could start to do that kind of tracking and look at all that stuff. But that's kind of what WorldGov does. And
it's a weird,
you know,
like, homogenizing of society where everything's sort of blend out into a socialism of like everybody's equal, like you make the same money, and then like everything went to a vote. It's as fair as possibly, and everything's as fair as it could possibly be. But man, but the weird little side effects of
like, we all have enough food, we all have enough clothing, we all have enough education, but I don't have the option of going to Harvard.
Right.
Like there, that's just, you know, I can't eat really, you know, I'm not going to get a gourmet meal this month because there's too many people on Earth and we're all going to eat. We've all got nutrition. The food tastes good, but I really wanted some lobster and I don't live in an area where lobsters are grown and I only have one food chit. So I'm not getting lobster.
I think like, that, you know, life as it is a roll of the dice already. And you get the cards that you're dealt, but I think at least you get to roll the dice normally. You know what I mean? Like you had your hand on those dice.
Right.
This one, the dice are in everyone else's hands. Like,
right.
So yeah, that's a trip. I don't think there's a perfect version.
No, there is not.
You know, without
not
getting political, obviously, but
it's not perfect. And you see, you know, I mean, Claire Campana is in the Navy and she's a good, you know, soldier,
got,
and she so
got a good roll
her,
of dice.
Her take on WorldGov and the World Navy is very, very positive.
Yeah,
like she thinks it's a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final, you know, branch is the messengers. And the framers sort of fill up that branch as well. It's the smallest of the branches. It's just a fraction of who is in all the other ones, but it's of equal, if not more importance, because the five messengers are the only five people on Earth who get the dreams from the alien group called the Kel. And basically it's even the, like, they usually don't even know what they're dreaming. It'll just be like, you like they'll have the same dream all night long of get a hammer, grab a sponge, and grab six screws.
Oh, it's that basic?
And then they're just like, okay. So the next day they get a hammer and they get a sponge and they get six screws.
I mean,
and
is that an analogy you're making right now?
No, this is literally what they would be. And then the next night,
they talk to each other?
It's take, you know, I have to, you know, soak the sponge in these four chemicals.
No wonder it's taking 120
years to do it. Because there's no, like, you're having to convey how to build this, you know, a living, unliving chemical sponge wall.
Well, right? I can't,
you don't have any of the infrastructure. So I just, every night you have to go over these steps over and over and over until you can wake up and do it. And once you've done it, you know, and they'll write it down and it's all, and then everybody else is like, okay, everybody start doing what that guy just did yesterday. And then eventually you've got this thing that humans could never
I
have.
I had more of an image of that. Have you guys seen Explorers from 1980 where they make the spaceship out of the Tilton Whirl?
No.
Oh God, you have to watch that tonight. Joaquin Phoenix is in it. The guy guy from Gattaca. What's his name?
Ethan Hawke.
Ethan Hawke is in it. Joaquin Phoenix.
Okay.
Well, not Joaquin Phoenix. River
Phoenix.
River Phoenix, his brother.
Yeah.
Great movie. These kids, one kid starts to dream and he dreams alien tech. They're sending him dreams through this crazy thing, but they're circuit boards. Like he's seeing circuit diagrams. Mm. And so I really had a vision that it was much more high tech. I didn't realize it was going to be like sponge hammer nails.
Well,
like,
no, but eventually, six months later, you're staring at a pool full of something that might be alive and might not.
And
if you shine a light on it, it like reflects, it refracts the light like 1,000% and has properties you can't even dream of.
It's exponential.
Of.
Now that you have the oubliac, you can make the other thing.
It's exponential. Okay. And now you can put that in this one wall of this thing you're building, and you're like, don't know what that did, don't know what it does for the ship, but the ship sure does weird shit, and that weird sponge thing in the wall must be part of it.
It's very Close Encounters, mashed potatoes, tear up your garden, build a mountain in your front room.
Well, I was thinking too, it's like how we think as educators, right? We want to get somebody to be able to write a coherent 10-page paper, but if you're taking somebody very basic, it's like you have to start them with a sentence,
right?
And then the
subject
paragraph.
I remember at BC they had us do an activity where we had to give instructions on how to make a peanut butter cracker sandwich.
Yeah.
Right.
To aliens.
Yep.
And that was a thing. And you couldn't use you can't say butter knife.
Yep.
Right.
You had to be so descriptive and in your technicality of like grabbing this utensil thing that's shaped in this way. And so you wrote out your instruction set and then you traded it with the other group and they followed it to the T to the point of being assholes. Like, I can't even start. I don't know what a fork is. You need to stop. So it makes sense. And some people would be like, I got half a peanut butter sandwich, but you know, you didn't, there's no way for me to really, and you don't see it yourself. So I think that way. Yeah. That's what they're having to deal with.
And they do communicate with them, but that's rare.
And you said they're called the Kel?
That's the shortening of the name of their society.
It's like some Klingon thing that you can't pronounce.
I could never pronounce it. I said it in the book, and I mispronounced it like 8 times in a row, and we had to keep recording it. It's the Kel Demokrasha is the name of the group.
I don't remember recording that, but all right. It's good to know.
Yeah.
Put a name on it.
I guess my last question is dealing with the messengers again. Is there anything else you can tell us about them? And what do you imagine it is like in their head?
And they're normal people, right? It could be a plumber or something, someone that's not a physicist.
Right.
Like their normal trade and their normal skill set doesn't play into the factor at all.
They're just, they're just the Lance Armstrong that was born. Like you've got the mutant heart that makes you the best cyclist on Earth. Like you just happen to be the best 5 people on the planet to receive these messages. So you are the 5 that are going to be
trained. So if one of them died, just the next best good. It's not like the Avatar where someone new is going to show up somehow.
No, if one of them died, then the next best would complete the training and start to receive.
You also mentioned that it was like to the point of maddening, like that they're crazy and they've lost their mind.
What's it like in their head?
Yeah, are they not functional in normal daily life? Or are they like in some protected environment where they're all at the same place in some pods, in some water cove where the government is watching over them? Or
no,
they're
functional.
They're living their life.
They're vocal, functional members of the, those top, all 4 of those government branches have 5 people at the top. So the true votes that occur on a global scale are 20 people, sitting at the top of the table.
So they're closely supervised in some structured environment. It's not that they're just like
they're fucking Looney Tunes. Like they're not normal people, and everyone who deals with them knows it. But they also at the end of the day, they'll suddenly say, we need to take every ocean-going naval vessel on Earth and sail them to Hawaii by next month. And you're like, okay.
Do what you said.
Just do it.
Unquestionable.
Right. And because even if you ask them, they're like, why are we doing this? They're like, I have no idea, but I've been getting that for 3 nights. And it's like, all right, do it. And then the next thing you know, they've done some weird thing that upgraded all of the vessels. And it's like, so they kind of have this bizarre cart. They're kind of Looney Tunes. But they've got entire staffs around them and ships and guards and everything. But in general, when they say, we have to do this, everybody else just says, do it. Like, you heard them.
They're like the little blonde girl in Harry Potter that can see Nargles. Like, she knows a bunch of weird shit, but she's like just off a little bit.
I'll have to take
I was thinking of
come on, bro. You don't know Nargles?
The computer brain guys in Dune. Like, the ones that do all the logistics.
The Mentats?
Yeah, the Mentats. Like, that's kind of what came to my head just for the fact that, they are functional, but they can be kind of crazy at certain points. And can
I feel like that's more of like a loss of emotion, overly mathematical, like too intelligent.
I agree. I just, it was just something where it was just like the amount of information because they're receiving all of this. It's the same way the Mentat has to like sit and like, I have to go over battles. Plans. I have to see like what supplies we have.
Right.
This.
The big difference would be that the Mentat actually understands what it is that they're calculating.
Yeah, that's true.
And the messengers are generally completely clueless. They're messengers. They're mouthpieces.
They don't live any other life though. It's
No.
Yeah.
No.
They sit there. What they do. It's only when they sleep.
Only when they sleep. Okay. Yeah.
During their wakeful hours.
That's when they're like part of the government and walking around doing and building the things that they had that they
facilitate.
You know, and they probably aren't building it anymore. They have a big staff, but they tell their staff, okay, grab a sponge,
so initially
a hammer,
they were like
screws.
The engineer out there doing it, even if they weren't an actual engineer. Like somewhat, they were the ones building. Okay.
Yep. Yeah,
yeah. Okay.
Does everyone in society go through the framing test or the framing exam?
No, it's your choice.
They could be missing some Dalai Lama somewhere. Mm-hmm.
Well, most people would.
Yeah.
I mean, most people do, but it's everyone's choice.
That's all I had for questions. Is there anything you wanted to add?
No, I think I didn't do anything depressing at the end, so we're good.
So as usual, if you go to mindframepodcast.com and go to the store, you can find both my book and Zach's books, and you can also find merchandise and buy some sweet merchandise.
I'm going to write a children's book just so we can throw it in there.
There you go. Again, we thank you for being patrons. We hope that this is entertaining and educational. Hopefully it sort of sheds some light on the chapters and makes it a little bit more fun to listen to them. And as always, the Lariat is closing.